Hello, it's Wednesday 9th of December. I'm Hannah Pearson from Per Anderson.
And I'm Gary Bauerman from Check In Asia.
On this week's show, we're pleased to chat with Simon Westaway, Executive Director of the Australian Tourism Industry Council. So, let's get started. This is the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Hello, wherever you are in the world, and thanks for listening in. Well, today it's our great pleasure to be talking all things travel and tourism down under with Simon Westaway, Executive Director of the Australian Tourism Industry Council. Simon, thanks very much for being on the show. How are you doing and where are you today?
Oh, it's a pleasure, Gary. I'm in the sunny Melbourne today, arguably the best, the best city on the planet, although it would always rival Vienna and a couple of others. But I'm actually in the Mornington Peninsula as we speak, so about an hour and a half out of beautiful Melbourne. And you can sort of feel the vibe of the holidays coming, and good news after a very turbulent 2020.
Yeah, that's a beautiful place to be, Simon. We've got plenty to talk about today, but just on the subject of Melbourne, you've had a torrid year there. What are things like right now? Is life back to normal?
Yeah, well, it's a great question. I think the suburbs and the outer burbs, everything's pretty much feels back to normal. The traffic snarls, which Melbourne never used to be renowned for, but in the last 10 or so years, it has really come back. It's nothing like a Jakarta traffic jam, but nonetheless, everyone's back out and about, and people are trying to obviously crunch through the last few working weeks before we hit the traditional downtime over Christmas New Year. And as you guys will appreciate, Australians do tend to take off that Christmas New Year period and into early January. It's sort of our siesta time of year. But Melbourne's getting its mojo back. It'd be fair to say there's a lot to do for the city. The CBD is a very dynamic, obviously European-facing city in many respects. So we have a lot of major events. The largest global sporting event in January across the planet being the Australian Tennis Open. We have the cricket. There's a lot of cultural events at this time of year. It's a little bit circumspect around how all that's going to go. There'll be obviously limits in terms of crowds. Although the way we're performing in terms of, zero community transmission of COVID for well over a month now, we've really turned the corner, but it's nothing like what's occurring in the States or parts of Europe. But obviously, we had a pretty poor few months ago, and we had at one stage we had over 700 cases a day, which is obviously very high for the Southern Hemisphere, and particularly this part of the world. But we are recovering. But the CBD, I think, it's got a long way to go. A lot of people still aren't back in the office. Most people are working from home. I think a lot like that idea. But 2021 or the first half of next year is going to be very interesting in terms of how the great city of Melbourne will try to reshape itself.
Yeah, so let's talk about you for a little bit. So you wear two business hats. So you're the Executive Director of the Australian Tourism Industry Council, and you're also Strategy Director for RoyceCom. So tell us about both roles and how do you manage to combine those two?
Yeah, I can feel a little bit schizophrenic. I sort of ended about a 25-year corporate career. I was a leader in corporate affairs, head of corporate affairs for a number of publicly listed companies. I guess I cut my teeth in travel and tourism initially through a regional airline called Impulse Airlines, which probably none of your listeners would have heard of, but Impulse became the shell for an airline called Jetstar, which you're probably much more familiar with. And I guess after Impulse was actually consumed by Qantas in the early 2000s after an unsuccessful domestic startup. It was a long term regional airline that tried to go into baby jets, and the model didn't quite work. Qantas saw some value in repurposing it with finance, new management. I was kindly invited to come back, and obviously a very strong investment in brand around a two brand strategy to kick off Jetstar, which occurred in May 2004. They say the rest is history. The initial plan was to basically to consolidate domestic leisure air travel in Australia for the Qantas Group, which they'd been losing market share to Virgin at the time. And ultimately, it evolved into a trans-Tasman operation and a Pan-Asian strategy, and setting up airlines, obviously a significant setup in Singapore, Japan, Vietnam, which had its sort of ups and downs. And, the plan was to try to sort of Jetstar the Southern Hemisphere, and now it's a very successful two-brand strategy, although obviously 2020 has been very difficult for that. In between all of that, I really got to love the tourism industry quite deeply over and above aviation, and I headed strategy at Tourism Australia for a number of wonderful years, and worked very hard on the China strategy for our country, you know, success has many many hat wearers, and but nonetheless, it's been obviously I guess probably the standout in the last 10 years in terms of our international success has been that China opportunity, and at the turn of 2019, we had actually more visitors coming in every year from China than we did from neighbouring New Zealand, and obviously with significant levels of spend. So lots of parts of the world have received lots of Chinese visitors pre the virus. Australia was nonetheless no different, but it was a very successful strategy. In terms of ROI, so I actually have some clients in some different parts of industry in terms of manufacturing, higher education and the like. As I said, it can feel a little bit schizophrenic. I guess there's a level of adaptability that you try to apply your commercial skill sets to. My love, however, is in this sector, and particularly travel and tourism, also aviation, and I think it's a nice segue, and I try to balance the two. And ATIC organisation is a large representative body for all the small business tourism operators around the country, and that's sort of our focus is in small business, our regions, and the bread and butter issues around our industry.
Yeah. So tell us a bit more about the Australian Tourism Industry Council, Simon, because I was reading an article the other day about from an academic, and he was talking about there are various industry bodies in Australian tourism. You also referenced there your time at Tourism Australia. So how do you guys all work together, and you know, do you get in each other's way at all?
Yeah, it's a great question. Look, arguably there's too many representative bodies. It's been... In Australia, it's actually very easy to develop an industry body. In fact, you could almost develop it out of your lounge room in some respects. I'm not at all trying to talk down our industry. You know, the visitor economy, as they call it in Australia, was a $150 billion visitor economy. So it's very significant. We have a large domestic operation. What's evolved, I guess, over the last 20 or 30 years is there's different segments of our industry that have really evolved as, I guess, our economy's matured and we've become more international facing in particular. So there's been a strong travel agents lobby, which have had a long traditional role. Business events emerge and required its own support. The airports have their own body. The airlines have their own sort of body, although they do a lot of their work, collective work themselves. And then I guess the big end of town, if you like, have their own sort of representation. And I guess it's sort of evolved that way. It's a great question. We do try to speak in one voice. I think a lot of people would prefer we speak in one collective voice. I'll leave the governance arrangements to others to try to work through. ATIC has been around for about 6 or 7 years, and we're a federated body. Our strength of our members is in our states, the states and territories, which we probably should talk a bit about. I think the power of the states and territories in our country, I think people haven't quite appreciated how strong they can be. And so we look at things from a federal perspective. So, yeah, look, it's a great question. I actually don't mind the multiple voices because our industry is made up of many, many forms. And, we have a large domestic sector. We had a very fast, rapidly growing international sector. You know, we've got some real niche areas as well around ecotourism and the like. But I think out of COVID, we will start to see some closer alliances occur. But we do all talk, and we do collaborate as best we can. So I try to don't get too caught up in the politics of who's saying what and why. We're all trying to push in the right collective direction, and that's the way I try to look at it.
Sure. So you referenced there it's been a difficult year. If we go back a year, Simon, this was the beginning of the bushfire season, the black summer. What damage did that do to Australian tourism, not just physically, but psychologically as well?
Oh, it was incredible. I actually did the big Europe trip with my young family, and we'd been saving for a while, and we did it. So we avoided the first part of it. We landed back in Melbourne in mid-January. I think Melbourne that day was the hottest city on the planet, towards 50 degrees, believe it or not, and obviously, we had the worst air quality in the world, and but I've been following it obviously quite closely. And in fact, I'd spent basically every evening that I did in London doing media through the night. And it's amazing with modern communications how you can get a feel for what's going on or a level of understanding. And we sort of got dragged into this issue. It had a devastating effect, not just in terms of the flora and fauna. I mean, there's arguments we lost somewhere. Upwards of 600 million animals. The brand damage to our country was significant. I mean, the social media memes did a lot of damage. I saw a report that possibly Uluru was on fire, which of course was a bit of a funny joke. But Tourism Australia calculated that the collective brand damage to Australia over that period was upwards of, you know, $7 to $8 billion in terms of just brand damage, and likely to have a, you know, exponential impact on that. And what was critical about everything was not just the loss of the peak summer season for a lot of our operators, but it's also the key booking window for the international market to book Australia. Generally, we have, you know, the booking window tends to be over that January period, particularly out of North America and Europe. Asia's a little bit different, but and of course they were faced with scenes of devastation, and it did have a real hit. And you're right, we just slid literally out of the fires straight into the virus, and so it's been a unbelievable year, and the industry's never seen anything like it. Collectively, we lost over, you know, half of our collective value. You know, some leaked figures said that the industry was down in the mid 60 billions Australian, and we were above 150 billion at the turn in the 2020 in terms of the economic value of the industry. So as you can see, it's been devastating, and it'll take probably upwards of 5 years to fully recover, and one would argue may never quite recover to where it once was.
Wow. When COVID came around, when did you start to see that impact on Australia's tourism?
It was a great question. So Australia's done very well out of Chinese New Year. Over the years, we've been increasingly seeing direct charter services, let alone obviously the significant level of capacity that the likes of China Southerns, China Eastern and Air China were bringing into Australia on a regular basis. And it was a very, very tricky period. The back end of the Chinese New Year celebrations, in fact, it was the day after Australia Day, our national day, you know, the federal government confirmed that we were going to be closing our border to Chinese nationals or people coming out of mainland China from the 1st of February. And so obviously didn't capture those Chinese nationals that were visiting or returning international students that were already in country, but obviously caught anybody that couldn't come from the beginning of February. And that's, Hannah, is where it hit pretty much straight away. So, I mean, the Chinese visitor was delivering $12.5 billion plus in visitor dollars to our national economy here and every year. There's a student component. The vast bulk of our international student audience comes from mainland China as well as Hong Kong. So we've seen that impact from that very early day. So it's a really good question and insight, because we hit it very early. We initiated border bans on South Korea soon after, a couple of other smaller countries, and then the collective hit in terms of our border fully closing occurred towards the back end of March. And then of course we had those domestic constraints which the states and territories applied. So it was a bit of a roller coaster, moved pretty quickly, but you could just see the numbers start to fall away from basically early February. We had some of our members and some businesses which were almost 100% wholly reliant on the Chinese visitor dollar, and literally went from almost 100% of revenue to literally zero intakes in a matter of a couple of weeks.
My goodness. You've mentioned there your two key markets, China and New Zealand, but also cruise travel was growing pretty fast in Australia in recent years, Simon. So how damaging was the Ruby Princess incident, not just at the time, but going forward for cruise in future?
Yeah, it was a metaphor. It was a metaphor around, I think Australia's done a good job collectively across the, we've invested a fortune. We've racked up a lot of debt to protect our economy as best we can and to keep the, you know, citizens satisfied, I suppose. But yeah, the Ruby Princess was a very difficult period for the industry. The cruise industry, really were, almost, eyes wide at midnight in terms of how they were going to deal with it. It was a major breach of public health protocol. A lot of finger pointing ensued. There's been inquiries into it. The fact that Ruby Princess had to sit around for a fair period and was moved out of Sydney Harbour quite dramatically down to a harbour just to the south of Sydney and sat there as almost like a tourist attraction for a short period before it then ultimately moved. Again, just to continue to remind people of that, of the impact. So that's had quite a devastating effect, because you're right, because cruise has been a growing part of our broader visitor economy offering. I mean, the aviation market has obviously been the way that, you know, most people are coming out of the country, but a large cruise market, a lot of Australians leave and go out to South Pacific, even domestic cruises as well as further journeys. But a lot of visitors, particularly from the likes of the US, come here by cruise. So it's been a difficult one, and indeed, just in the last 24 hours, we've had the update from our federal government that we won't be allowed as citizens to leave the country unless we're permitted to, with a permit until later March, and that's with some specific applications to the cruise industry as well. So the implications continue.
Yeah. I mean, in going forward, you know, when cruises are permitted, do you think the Australian market are still going to be keen on them? Or do you think that there's going to be this kind of long lasting psychological damage almost about taking cruises?
Look, Australians are very strong travellers. We're one of the, as a country, we want to have one of the highest percentages of held passports as a percentage of the country. So the vast majority of Australians hold a passport. I mean, travel has become ingrained in us. It's been interesting. I can get quite economic here. You know, real wages in our country have pretty much stagnated in the past 5 or 6 years, even though we've had, you know, good levels of employment and we've had low inflation and the like. But people's percentage spend of their household budgets in terms of travel has arguably continued to go up. And that's due to a whole bunch of reasons. But basically, we've had the travel bug for a long period of time. And, you know, it's almost a rite. It is a basically a rite of passage. A former prime minister basically said it was a rite of passage for young Australians after they left school or tertiary education to hit the road or hit a jump on a plane and head overseas. So, and I think that's become part of our fabric as a country. So, yeah, look, it's an interesting one. In terms of cruise, I actually think people will get back on the vessels. You know, I think our public health response has been so strong that, and the industry is trying really hard to say we can make this work. But yeah, look, I think there's a few things do need to happen. We do need to embrace some sort of a broader approach to how we can successfully, sustainably reboot, both through air and cruise. We do need to better embrace you know, antigen testing, rapid testing as part of the mix. PCR testing is the predominant way that people are measured for the virus here. You know, we have the challenge around our hard border and the mandatory quarantine arrangements that come as a result of that. And so we've got some big questions to ask in the next few months around how we actually can physically reopen, and not just for people leaving the country, but for visitors coming, because unless we can get around this hard 14-day you know, quarantine arrangement, either in a hotel or in some other physical location, it's a huge disincentive, obviously, for any type of leisure travel. In fact, people are now predicting we could be out to around about 2024, 2025 in terms of when we get to a level of recovery which is could sustain the industry in its current form or previous form.
So let's talk travel bubbles, Simon. This is something that Hannah and I have been talking about for months. But Australia and New Zealand actually bequeathed this term to the world back in late April. The two prime ministers were talking at some point of developing a two-way trans-Tasman bubble. So what happened after that announcement? I guess you guys were working over that for a number of months to try and put it in place?
Yeah, look, it's great. We did. That's right. I mean, it was in terms of the getting out of the blocks and travel bubbles, we were it. I mean, we had two countries, Australia and New Zealand. We're very close. We don't like each other when we play sport, but we're very close to each other. We've, you know, relatives, friends, so forth on both sides of the Tasman. So, and it looked, it seemed logical. New Zealand took a slightly different pathway around managing COVID to Australia. They probably went even harder than we did. We went for a slightly more suppression strategy. They went, in essence, for elimination. Look, in essence, we got to the same sort of place, as you said, by mid-year. And we had the two prime ministers speaking regularly, even though they're from sort of different political persuasions in terms of the political divide, but both were very very keen and wanted to get this happening. And quite frankly, I think it was almost a laydown bazaar it was going to occur in the third quarter of this year. A few things happened, though. I mean, I think part of the issue has been the whole way through the travel bubble in terms of the Trans-Tasman. There's been too many cooks. There's been a lot of government input and department input and bureaucratic input. I don't know if there's been the level of input asked of the airports and the airlines who actually have to get on with it. That's just a theory of mine. The other issue, of course, is that we had the second wave of the virus in Australia, which, of course, has occurred in those parts of the world. And that second wave really took hold in Victoria, in southern Australia, and for a while there, for a number of weeks, we had trouble getting on top of it. And that happened at a time when I think the conversations were getting pretty crunchy around the bubble, and we also had election cycles in place. The other thing is the election cycles in our parts of the world are pretty political, ironically enough, and borders and strength on borders and strength on keeping borders hard closed or with very few gaps is proven to be politically popular. There's been a number of elections at a state and provincial level in Australia. Indeed, the New Zealand election occurred this year, and unsurprisingly, the incumbent, which had strong border policies, has either strengthened not only one, but in pretty much every case, strengthened their majority. So it's been proven to be politically popular. even though everyone said it's all about health, politics got involved in this. So it's going to be really interesting to see where it's at. Our prediction is that we'll see a proper two-way bubble occurring by April next year. But Australia has permitted New Zealand nationals and returning Australians to come in with no quarantine since mid-October, and that's been going quite well. I don't believe the numbers are overly high, but they're coming in outside of the passenger cap that we have at the moment. We're only allowing 6,000 arrivals a week, but those New Zealand numbers sit outside that.
So it's coming up to summer in Australia now, which is obviously peak season for tourism. You know, a research paper by the CTF said 3/4 of domestic travellers will travel within their own state that summer. Is that still looking to be the way it's going to pan out? Are people still going to be sticking to their own states? Are they going to be interstate? Because we know that there's been big issues, I suppose, within interstate travel within Australia this year.
Yeah, it's a great question, Hannah. I think it's evolving. The TTF research is on the money around that intrastate, if you like, within region or within your state or province, for your international listeners to try to describe it. And we've seen that actually come back pretty quickly in most parts of Australia, where once community transmission has been nailed on COVID, and we've seen people getting in cars predominantly and camper vans and others and doing day trips predominantly or overnight stays in boutique parts of regional Australia or the many coastal attractions that we have, and it's sort of drive and flop or drive and explore type of thing. So, you know, in fact, there's many businesses have reported in takings which have been the strongest they've ever had in recent times in some parts of the country. So look, that's a silver lining on what's a more difficult issue. I think people are starting to understand now that the states and territories have been so harsh on the borders. They've been politicised, and we've only seen borders really, really lift when we've had an election out of the way or a lot of political pressure applied over a long period of time. So I think people are starting to understand now that's not going to occur too much anymore, because whilst hard border policies were popular in the past, I'm not too sure they'll be so popular moving forward. So I think we have seen a late surge of interstate bookings. Queensland are talking about a lot of bookings that have occurred. Flight Centre, Qantas are saying they're seeing some really big booking intakes in recent times, not just desire to, but actual bookings. But I do think a lot of people will stay close to home this Christmas, New Year. Beyond all the hype, I think the safety of being more closer to your place of residence is a good one, because if the borders shut hard quickly and you're caught, you've got to quarantine, and it's obviously very impractical.
So I'm going to put you on the spot, Simon. This is a question I hate being asked in interviews, and that's what's the outlook for 2021? So looking ahead a little bit, you've mentioned there that borders will probably remain closed at least until March. How important is a vaccine for the borders to reopen in Australia?
Yeah, vaccine's really important. I think it's got to be complemented with a bit more of a risk-averse approach to how we deal with the broader treatment of people around moving, particularly in terms of the international border. And that is, you know, we need a rapid uptake of antigen, rapid testing, and we need to break the conundrum that we've got currently around our international border of the hard 14-day quarantine. I don't think anyone's saying we don't do 14 days quarantine, but around it perhaps maybe doesn't need to be in a hotel, or can we try to shorten that period over time? Now, obviously, we've got a model in terms of New Zealand where it appears to be working quite well, and all the feedback out of government, which at times can be a bit limited, is that that micro bubble, as I call it, one-way bubble, is going quite well. New Zealand are yet to reciprocate. We're hoping, as you alluded to, that should occur by, one would hope, March, April next year. We've got to seriously look at how we go to reopen our economy and reopen our border to international visitors. Australia is so well placed as we move forward. Safety and security have always been the outside of our nature and broader offering has always been what's been compelling about Australia. And in the post-COVID world, you know, Australia looks like a bit of a beacon on the hill in terms of basically zero virus, and we seem like we're back to normal. But as we know, all the pressure will be people coming in. They're coming from places that may well have the virus in much larger numbers. So we've got a lot of work to do. Our bureaucracy have been nervous for obvious reasons. We've had Ruby Princess. We've had hotel quarantine breakout in Victoria. Even in the last couple of days, we've seen we had a German family or a couple, I think it was actually a mother and a son, got off an inbound international flight and somehow sweet-talked their way past a local policeman in Sydney and then found themselves on a domestic flight to Melbourne without going into quarantine, and was apparently a quick wittedness of a high carb provider in Melbourne at the airport realised that these people had just come off a plane and hadn't had any type of screening. So we've got some holes. It's not Swiss cheese, but we do have some holes. We've got to work through what it looks like. So to long way of answering your question, I'm not that optimistic about the international return. I am optimistic that we can work on some cohorts, such as backpackers, the Working Holiday Maker program, which is very successful here, international students. I'd love to see some leisure bubbles emerging out of New Zealand, Pacific Islands, Singapore, Japan. That would be fantastic. I think they can come, but they're more likely to be in the second half of 2021.
And do you see any other Southeast Asian countries that might be potential kind of travel bubble partners with Australia? So we talked about Singapore. Any of the other markets you think the government might go for?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think Singapore's a Monty. Japan, even though Japan's had higher incidence of COVID over recent periods, our Prime Minister made a very well-publicised trip up there. And whilst travel bubbles and travel wasn't the top priority of the visit, it was raised on a number of occasions. I think Australia would love to be able to embrace a return to Japan. I think there's opportunities for South Korea, Taiwan, and look, quite frankly, China, maybe be from particular provinces. The appetite is there, and I think we're savvy enough as a country to work this through, possibly in terms of mono-destinational type of travel or coming in from in one particular port or coming from one particular part of China and seeing if we can make that work, possibly with only one or two airlines so we can keep an eye on it. And look, I've been following really closely what's happening on the Singapore-Hong Kong travel bubble side and just broadly around the world. And as you guys follow closely and as a lot of us are watching closely, is travel bubbles are really difficult. And I think it's going to take a level of risk adversity to get over the fact is that there will be ongoing incidents of the virus. So if we do get it going, how can we do it as safely and efficiently as we can, and what systems we need to have in place, and possibly having short-term quarantine arrangements mandatorily in a hotel, but then using antigen testing, rapid testing to see if there's any incidence of the virus, and then monitor people to a degree. I know it sounds very complicated, but I think we've got to try and start somewhere. I'm a big believer in the backpackers, Working Holiday Makers. At any one time, we have over 200,000 of them come to this country, mainly out of Europe, but also Asia. And they work hard in this country. They travel to and through. Their value's worth well over $3 billion a year in terms of collective spend. We've got one of the best programs in the world here. And it's, I think they're ones that we could really encourage to come back, because they'd be more than happy to quarantine if they're wanting to stay here for up to 3 years, but then use that as a potential test base for what we need to do to then try to invite other groups back in over time.
Simon, I was really interested what you were saying there about the borders opening in terms of cohorts. That's something that we've been talking about quite a lot over the recent months, is that, travel at the moment initially looks like it's going to be charter-based for the initial period of the recovery. Now, outbound travel from Australia is very, very strong. Australians are great travellers. They do tend to travel into Southeast Asia and into the Asian region generally. But do you think it's going to be a case of it'll be done on a phased basis? It won't just be opening the border so Australians can go out en masse again?
Yeah, we'll be done on a phased basis. So we got the sobering news that we can't leave our country unless we have a permit to do so until the 17th of March 2021. Wasn't really slipped through. I think most people felt that we're going to get a further restriction. It's an intellectual argument that our industry needs to take up, though, because we do need to encourage the two-way flow of travel. To your point, Australians are significant travellers. We had 9.5 million short-term arrivals in 2019, but we had close to 12 million short-term outbound departures. So Australians travel in significant volumes, mainly for leisure, but also for visiting friends and relatives and for business purposes as well. We go to, obviously, Indonesia is very popular, New Zealand, Singapore, broader Southeast Asia, but there's a lot more Australians going to places like Japan, the US, obviously, than Europe. So we do need to really try to encourage that to occur. And I think it will be through cohorts, possibly could be through business travellers, but I hope we think a bit more outside the box than that, because business travellers have specific requirements, but it's a pretty narrow cohort. I'd love to see it, let's be a bit more expansive, pick a market, pick some cohorts, see if it can work, and then we try to expand relatively quickly. As the vaccine vaccines start to settle in and hopefully work well, we might be more, a bit more comfort from authorities, during later parts of 2021 to try to explore further out.
Just before we come to the final question, Simon, what is the current situation for vaccine procurement in Australia?
Yeah, well, it's near not 100% across, but our health minister in the last week outlined that he's looking at March as the sort of kickoff point. We've got we've invested in a number of the different vaccine opportunities out there. Australia is well placed. The Oxford vaccine, sorry for the simplistic response there, is one that we're particularly involved in. Yeah, so I think where the positioning is at is that March is going to be an important sort of segue, pivot point for our country in terms of where we're at. I think our authorities want to see how the vaccines that are starting to hit the market, how they work, and then we'll be in a position to be able to implement. My understanding is there's been heavy pre-orders of vaccine from the various providers so that we've been in a position to start to roll this out within our community. And as I understand, it'll be from March, all things going to plan. So I think that gives you a bit of a guide. And I take a big steer from Qantas. Qantas are really saying that, from their perspective, it's the second half of 2021 where they can only start to seriously see any level of international services commencing again. That's outside New Zealand. And I think that's a pretty strong steer that, hopefully the second half of 2021, vaccines are starting to be in play, good testing, the virus is under control in more countries that we like to trade with, and hopefully we can start to see some people moving again.
Last question for you then. So what are your own hopes and thoughts for travel in 2021? And where is your first trip going to be once it's possible to travel again?
That's a great question. Well, look, I would really love to get back to, I'm a big fan of Indonesia. I really love Bali. There's many elements of Bali. I'd love to get back there. I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon. I can see my family have connections to Thailand. I can see us getting back there at some point in the next year, hopefully. But for me and for us, we're going to do some more domestic travel. I've seen a lot of our beautiful country, and it's fantastic. I'd love to get back up to Broome. I do think Broome is one of the most compelling propositions for a visitor. It's mainly domestic visitors in Australia, not a lot of international visitors. I think the Kimberley is one of the just truly amazing parts of our country, which not everybody here in this country has seen. I've seen a lot of the Gold Coast, and I've seen a lot of Queensland, and I've seen a lot of New South Wales, which is my old home. But you could never knock back a trip up to the Sunshine Coast around Noosa if that opportunity presents. So I don't know. I quite frankly consider myself spending a lot more time in my home state than I can travelling next year, but outside of work. But I do see a trip up to Western Australia, up to the Kimberley, hopefully in the next 6 months.
Let's hope that happens. So thank you so much for being our guest today, Simon. And that brings us to the end of this edition of the Southeast Asia Travel Show. We hope you enjoyed the show. And as always, we'd love to read your feedback on what we've said or what we've missed out. So email us at hello@theseasiatravelshow.com and look out for our daily travel insights and podcast news on LinkedIn at the Southeast Asia Travel Show and Twitter at SEA Travel Show.
Yeah, meanwhile, you can catch up with the Southeast Asia Travel Show's full 1-year-long back catalogue. The show started exactly a year ago in December 2019 on our website, www.theseasiatravelshow.com. Also on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, Castbox, Podchaser, and Stitcher. That list just keeps getting longer. Just search for the Southeast Asia Travel Show on each one.
And that's a wrap for this week. And we look forward to talking Southeast Asian travel and tourism again with you very soon.
Yeah, thanks very much, Simon.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.